Let's start. Couple of higher level announcements. Project Part C is going to be sort of officially opened this week. The important thing to remember is the project would be due and the demos would be due by the end of this month, because May 1st is the last class. So it's like the last class of the semester is May 1st, and then after that is reading class, reading day, and then the end of the semester. So the project Part C and the demos, everything, the deadlines would be by the end of the month, April end. Okay, that's to keep in mind. Basically, the idea for the project, I mean, I'm going to modify some things. We are just still working on making some minor changes, but it's going to be close to, where are we? I have a project somewhere. It's going to be close to the version that we had before, I mean the version that was there previously. I have to obviously, I'm going to change the dates and so on. The way it's going to be is that you could just take what we ask you to do, or you could do something else. So basically, starting from the piece of the code that you have, which does simple search with link analysis, we'll give you the default that everybody can work, I mean, that you can work on is essentially doing clustering of the search results and to see if, in fact, a retrieval and a precision and recall can be improved by doing clustering of the search results. And then you can use different kinds of clustering algorithms. That's basically, we will give you the details for where to get the code for that, etc. But you can also propose to do some other different extensions. We'll give some ideas, but you can essentially, if there is something that you always wanted to do with respect to your search engine, you have a working search engine, a small prototype, you can do it. Okay, but if you do that, then you may want to quickly talk to either me or the TA regarding the feasibility of what it is that you're trying to do. Okay, because it has to be done by the end of the month. Okay, plus or minus one day is possible, but beyond that, essentially the May 1st is the last class for the semester. Okay, so you can look at this, you would not lose much by looking at the current version as it exists there. Basically, there's like a bunch of extra credit ideas that were there, but in fact, you could even consider just doing some of the extra credit ones, because some of them were independent of the clustering extension. But there are also other things that you can consider doing. Okay, so there is, if you have no additional imagination, there is a safety net. You know, we'll tell you what you can do, and then of course you'll do more the whole thing, or you can do something else. Okay, that's basically the idea. And again, yes.
For this third part, are we expected to work off all the code that we have right now? Because some of us haven't got some of the things working. Like,
well, no, you have to. So irrespective of whether you got it working before or not, by the end of the semester, everything has to be demoed. So if you did not get pieces working before, you can still get it to work and then demo it. And if you are just, if it so happens that you are not using anything about link analysis and search, but you're doing a completely different kind of extension, which is possible, in which case, just let me know what it is, and then you will demo that. Okay. So the default is things are built on top of each other, and so you'll have something that also does clustering by the end. Okay. But I've seen way too many variations on that, so if somebody else wants to do something else, be my guest. Okay. You did two pieces, I mean, I think the main thing that you did was last one, which you did link analysis along with IR style retrieval. So you have some idea as to how that works. Okay. Any questions on that? I will send a mail saying it's officially open, but it's really open. I mean, you know, the end is near, you know, the end is end of April. So you may as well start thinking about it. The other issues are that there is homework 3, which, remember, we almost were about to close the slot socket, but I never did, and so we couldn't use that information, that material on the exam. It's going to be closed this week, and it'll be due maybe about a week from now, okay? Because I want to open a new homework 4, that contains all the stuff about XML and semi-structured data and all that, okay? And the last homework may, you know that it has to be ending by the end of the semester. So I don't necessarily give guarantees that, you know, I'll tell you 1 week ahead of time that, you know, this is closed. So you should be, I reserve the right to say it's closed, give it to me tomorrow. So, you know, for the homework 4, make sure that you keep on top of it. Homework 3 is likely to be, I'm assuming you've already done most of the homework 3. So I'll add some questions on collaborative and content-based filtering, and we're done with that. Okay. Project Part B has actually been graded, but we decided to do some slight regrading of various parts, so I cannot return it to you today. I'll return it to you next class. The exam is too long to grade. I don't know how you guys dealt with it in terms of actually doing it. So I'm doing it, you know, I'm still behind schedule on the exam. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So what I am going to be doing today is XML, which is sort of boring, but, you know, since not everybody probably knows it, we have to do it. Let me just first start by reminding you the last class we started, you know, we made a kind of jump into the third part of the semester where we're going to look at structure explicitly. So handling structure. And if you're handling structure, databases are, you know, meant for handling structure, and so those are useful things to understand. And so we talked about why we even care about databases, and there's this deep web idea, and we can do better query processing with structured data idea. And then also, databases themselves will change if you expose them to the kind of users that are out there. Okay, are there any questions on this stuff? Any thoughts that cross your mind, etc.? There is that, and there's that. Okay, so somewhere along the line, I mentioned, for example, for a couple of reasons, so everything at the bottom part in each slide, wrapper generation, schema mapping, form filling, query optimization, and similarly, how to support keyword queries, how to support imprecise queries, how to handle incompleteness, inconsistency, and also techniques for extracting information, languages for representing and handling semi-structured data, and standards for supporting and exploiting semantic tagging. These are the pieces that we'll wind up doing for the rest of the semester. Okay, they don't get done exactly in that order. So in fact, the first thing that we'll be looking at today is XML, and it's best understood from the point of view of languages for expressing for representing and handling semi-structured data. Okay, it's a syntactic standard for representing semi-structured data. Okay, so that's what we'll start with, and then, you know, hope we'll go through the rest of them in order, in some different order. So that's basically brings us to XML. How many of you already know too much about XML and sick and tired of it? Where have you been? So it looks to me that I was thinking this is going to be a boring class because everybody knows everything anyway, but I don't know. So how many of you have heard of XML? I don't know. Okay. I mean, heard in the sense of, for example, how many of you know the connections between XML and databases? Okay. See. Okay. So as they say when they show reasons, if you haven't watched it before, it's new. So if you don't know this, it's all new for you. I mean, the part of the problem is XML is probably being discussed in a variety of different contexts now, and so I wasn't sure how many of you already know it. Apparently, most of you don't. So it's good. I get to describe it my way. So let's think of what are the main motivations for XML as a standard. Before doing that, this is an example of XML. Okay. And we'll talk about some things later, but let me jump ahead a little bit. Okay. This is an example of XML. This is an example of XML2, which is called HTML. Okay. I mean, in case you haven't ever thought about what these are like. Okay. So now, first of all, what's the difference? Both of them seem to have tag begin, tag end, and they can have nested tags. Okay, that much is for sure. And then between tags, you can essentially have character data, you know, strings, text, stuff. Okay, that's what you have in here as well as here. So, what's the main difference that you see between this and this? This is clearly, HTML is clearly a subset of XML, where each of these tags they have meaning, but they have a meaning only for the rendering agent, the rendering program. Okay, so the rendering program knows that H1 means make it header, so make it in big letters. Okay, and similarly BR break so that the new line will start, P paragraph, I italics, and that's it. Okay, so these are tags, except these tags mean, now whenever you put tags, one of the interesting point is, if you do not have the tags, it's just a bunch of character data. These tags are annotations on the data, on the character data. And these annotations should mean something for somebody. Let's think in these ways, okay? In HTML, the tags only mean something to the humans. Now, I'm sorry, not humans. The tags only make some sense to the rendering agent. However, we actually already played with this, because since the rendering agents think of H1 to be header and they make it big, and the rendering agents are rendering it so that humans with eyes will see them, in a way H1 also has indirect meaning and impact on humans, right? H1 somehow means big letters, means important, and we use this in IR. Right, we actually wound up giving higher weight to the words that were appearing in between the H1 tags, for example. So we already started giving more meaning to these tags than they were supposed to have, than they were intended to have, which is they're supposed to be only meaningful to the rendering agent. And yet we knew that by, you know, as an indirect consequence, they also have some meaning to the humans. Okay, and so you use that in the context of search. Now, if you look at it this side, here you kind of give up on this indirect route and we just start having tags. These tags mean something to you, at any rate, to you the human. So this bibliography, book, begin, title, and then some foundations, title end, author name, author end, author name, author end, publisher, publisher end, year, year end, book, book end, and then this beginning of bibliography, end of bibliography. Now the interesting thing here is, here the tags do not directly mean anything to the rendering agent. Okay, now you can think of this as a big step forward or a big step backward. At least here the tags meant something to somebody in the world, which is the rendering agent. Here they actually don't mean anything to anybody. If it means something to you, it's because you are overloading what you know about the word bibliography in the dictionary onto that word there. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's one thing that you want to keep in mind is, if you are putting these tags, these mean something to you, the user, okay, just because you happen to know the language. Okay. One of the interesting things that people are interested in this type of tags is that hopefully they are providing the structure of the data in a more semantic sense. Okay, so for example, here is the bibliography which has a book item. A book item has a title item and an author item and the multiple authors and a publisher and a year. Okay, it looks like you are delineating data into semantic pieces. Okay, the one thing that I'll keep repeating through the class, probably to the point of annoyance, is that the semantics is in the eye of the beholder. And in fact, there is no semantics there. All this is actually, if the difference between this and this is essentially, you know, if you think of this, let's say the book. So you can think of this as a relational database tuple. Okay, it's a table. A table called book. It has columns, title, multiple author columns, a publisher column, and a year column. Okay, now when you give names to the columns of a database, by the way, I'm assuming after a Knox class, since there was no revolution and there was no complaint, that everybody knows relational databases. Okay, if not, you should have looked at the rest of the slides of the relational database stuff. So I'll assume that as part of the background that we all share. Okay, so the column names in the relational database are just names. They don't necessarily, you know, if you call the column here, instead of calling it title, if you call it some other string, it does not change anything. It's still the data with a different set of columns. Okay. However, it does have the advantage. So from the point of view of databases, why is this interesting? It's because we'll see in a minute that it provides a way of transferring tables from place to place by tuple. Okay, this is one useful thing. Okay, so if you remember your relational database literature, there is no syntactic model for relational databases. There is no syntactic model for representing the relational data. You have tables, which are essentially your conceptual view of how the data is organized. Now, if you want to transfer a tuple from one place to the other on the internet, for example, you need to tell the receiving end guy that here is the name of the column, here's the value. Here's the name of the column, here's the value. Here's the name of the column, here's the value. If nothing else, if you don't tell that, how will they at least put it back? You know, if you just send it as, you know, 5 comma separated pieces, what are those pieces supposed to be? What I can say is, if I send this record, book begin, title begin, some junk, title end, author begin, some junk, author end, and another author begin, another author end, and so on, the other side guy can at least capture this piece of data and say, well, I know what are the column names. I don't know what they mean, but I know what the columns are. I also know where each of these pieces and what are the columns and what are the values. So you can reconstruct the data at any rate by the transfer. This looks like a very, very, very simple extension. You know, I mean, all you need is some sort of a standard such that we can talk to each other. It turns out that this is like a huge, big advantage of XML from the database point of view. A second advantage from the database point of view tuples like this, of records like this, is in a standard relational databases, you are supposed to decide upfront for a book how many authors are there. Because you have to decide how many columns are there in the table for the authors. Either you can say there is a single column called authors, which contains the list of all authors, or you have n columns called author 1, author 2, author 3, up to author n. And if the book only has one author, then rest of author 2 to author n, what are they? They're null values. Null values means there is no value there. Okay. Now, in general, when you're writing relational schemas, one of the things you assume is all tuples in a table have exactly the same syntactical structure. If you have a table, the table has all tuples of exactly the same syntactical structure. So when you, before you decide on a book, you have to decide exactly how wide is the book, wide in terms of number of columns. Now, well, authors, I don't know, some books have 15 authors, some books have 2 authors, some books have 1 author. How many columns am I going to put? So I would be forced normally in relational database, say, relational databases in such situations to either decide arbitrarily a large number of author columns and, you know, populate them with null values if there are not that many authors, or have a single column for authors and put all the authors as a list of authors in that place. And the third alternative is to have one table for books with single authors, another table for books with 2 authors, another table for books with 3 authors, and so on. What you're doing there essentially is, when I have tuples like this, when I have records like this, that in essence, they are allowing me to represent tables whose column structure can be disjunctive. So this one single tuple essentially is saying, I can have a book with either one author, or I can have a book with 2 authors, or so on. Okay, without actually explaining upfront how many authors are. So in a relational database, you have to exactly state upfront how many authors are there. No more, no less should be sent to you. In this kind of a scenario, I can say that a book has normally more than one author. So you should have at least one author, equal to or more than one author. So you should at least have one author, maybe 2, maybe 3, maybe 15. So in saying that, you are able to actually represent a disjunction of these tables with this kind of record. Yes?
Generally, if we design the relational database, we do it in an online query, put it in a separate table, and we still get this, the same flexibility here.
No, so the idea is, without telling you upfront, as I'm sending you the data, I don't have to tell you how many. So I'm not talking about once you receive this data, how to store it. In fact, if you want to store XML efficiently and do query processing on it, there are all these questions as to what's the best way to store XML, either in a relational database, in which case you want to have fixed width tables, because relational databases only support fixed width tables. Okay? Or you can represent in a different representation. What I'm talking about is, when you're transferring individual records, I don't have to tell you up front. The tuples describe themselves.
Okay.
See, it's self-describing, and the schema, the inherent schema of the tuples can essentially be disjunctive. I use the word disjunctive in the sense it could be multiple possible tables all together. Okay? And so this idea is, you know, if you think of this as fully structured, that means every tuple has exactly the same number of columns as being fully structured. Then if you don't know whether it has 5 columns, 6 columns, 7 columns, you think it's in between 5 and 20 columns. That's sort of less than fully structured, but more than no structure. So if there's less than fully structured and more than no structured, semi-structured. Okay? So, in fact, keep that in mind. Let's go back to the first slide. And let's talk about why XML once again. There are 3 possible reasons that are given. One is a fake reason, the other are real reasons. Okay? The one reason is the web needed a more declarative format for data, trying to describe the meaning of the data. Okay? That's a fake reason. Because just because I wrote bibliography, I didn't give any meaning. I mean, I only gave meaning to you if you happen to know what bibliography meant. Okay? Documented from an IR side, documents needed a mechanism for extended tags to mark structure. That means from an IR side, you're thinking of each document to be just a bag of words. It's true that, and that one extreme is this document can be fully parsed and converted into, you know, you can do natural language processing on it, find parse trees for it, do semantic analysis, convert it into some, you know, declarative representation. That's the full extreme end. So then, you know, from the 471 point of view, each document will then become a bunch of first order logic sentences, let's say, or whichever good knowledge representation that you love. And then you just do inference on them. So query processing is inference on knowledge. That's what it's supposed to be. Okay? That's too far away. But, you know, so instead we are actually in the other extreme where document is just a bag of words. But there is a whole spectrum in between. Documents have structure. For example, documents have big, you know, the title of the document. They have sectional structure. They have contents. They have, for example, if it's a document which is of the technical report type or a computer science paper type, it will have a title. It will have an author block. It will have an address block. It will have an abstract. It will have introduction, section 1, section 2, section 3, etc., and then references. Right? I would like to be able to tell you the search engine, that this document is not just a simple list of, you know, simple set bag of words. It has more structure. With, you know, the full extreme is I'll just tell you the exact logical, you know, knowledge, the exact formal representation of the knowledge encoded in the file. But somewhere in between, I may just want to tell you, these are all the pieces. You know, this piece is section 1, this piece is section 2. Okay? Now, why is that useful, first of all? I have mentioned it in the beginning of the semester, that any structure can help you do better query processing. So, for example, if I'm asking for all the papers that cites Rao's paper, but are not written by Rao, okay, because I mean in science, you know, I mean those of you who start writing papers, you know that, you know, there is this interest in increasing your citation count by adding, you know, more citations to your own work. So every paper repeats all the other papers that you ever wrote in the reference section. Okay, now I would like to know, in terms of true citation count, I would like to know, you know, papers written, papers that seem to be citing Rao's paper but are not written by Rao. This is sort of, I mean, you know, because you have done all this Google analysis, this is exactly the PageRank, PageFarm ideas, where you want to know the links that are coming from some outside domain, in essence. Okay, now, for a minute, forget about how you can defeat these kinds of techniques, these kinds of concepts. But even if you want to just answer that question, if you just have a bunch of text, you know, a file which is just represented as a bag of words, then if the Rao appears like 5 times, I don't know where it's appearing. I want to know whether Rao appears in the references section with Rao not appearing in the title section, I mean in the author section. If I told you the sectional structure of the document, you can actually answer this query. If I didn't, you can't answer this query. So there you go. I gave you a query that couldn't be answered with bag of words, but could be answered with extra structure. So oftentimes, this kind of sectional structure of the documents is easily available. People are willing to write it as part of their documents. And so if they want to write it, what they should all agree on some standard, okay, some syntactic standard at any rate. Okay, so from the IR community, they were saying, look, text has no structure whatsoever. We need to have a language which allows us to encode both text as well as stuff that has more structure. So that's what IR people will be looking at. So they needed something like XML, which basically says section begin, bunch of text, section end. Section begin, bunch of text, subsection end. References begin, and bunch of text, references end, for example. Okay? That would be the way IR folks would be interested in XML, because it's giving the pieces of the document. Okay? From the database side, there were two reasons that I already mentioned as to why people were interested in something like this tagged XML sort of languages, syntactic standards. One is that you want to be able to send tuples on the wire. Okay. Now, what was happening before was the following, right? In fact, even if there is a database which is sending out, which is sending out some tuples, since if you think of web as just HTML, the first thing that database would have done is it would have had a front end which would convert this tuple into a bunch of HTML text. Okay? And that would be rendered to you, rendered on the browser. Now, if you are a human, you are happy because, it's all written in text and you can understand text. If you are on the other side, if you are another database, then what you're doing essentially is you're finding a way of taking this pseudo text and converting it back into tuple form. So this is the issue that I was talking about earlier. The capital of India is New Delhi. Could be written there. And then this guy busily has to unwrap it and say, start from the beginning of the line, skip, pick word, and skip, pick word, and then you now have two words. The first one is country, the second one is capital, and it's already bogus because there are some countries which have two words in their name, and there are many cities like New York which have two words in their name. Okay, so you can see how this unwrapping can get really annoying. All this guy can say now is, what it can do is just, let's say, the capital of Now, the fact that these names, country and city, mean something to you is less important here. Even, all you need now is you know how to skip. Skip until the column name, first column name has been found, then parse until the end of that column name has been found. That's the first column's value. So you can always unwrap XML. You don't need an unwrapping as a separate component because it's just coming with the tags. Okay? So for example, if everybody follows XML, you don't need to unwrap. There is no wrapper generation issues that are required. Okay, in fact, wrapper generation and maintenance is needed only because people don't follow XML. Right now, even now. Okay? That's one idea. The other thing is, from a more semantic point of view, relational data is structured, but it's a very rigid structure. Okay, it says all tables have, each table has a specific width, exactly the certain number of columns. Okay, I might want to, for example, combine structured and unstructured data. I might want to allow multiple authors for some tuples. I might want to just put extra unstructured text in some places. Okay, so from the relational data point of view, less structure, ability to handle less structure is actually something that you're interested in. Okay, and you come from here with looking for more structure, you come from here looking for less structure, and depending on how you come to XML, you look for different things in XML. There's only one XML, but database people look at it and do certain things with it, and IR people look at it and do certain other things with it. Okay, but it's one of these, there is no Markov property, it does depend on where you came from. And if you came from IR, for example, here is a classic point. Let me just look at this. XML and order. Okay, if I have this, right, book price, title, author, year, this is XML. right? I mean, I'll again look at the syntax in a minute, but I assume that you've seen this kind of structure before. Now, should anything change if I change the order of the authors? Should anything change if I put author above and title below? What, you know, the question is, what I'm saying is, does the order in which things appear in a file have an impact on what is meant by that file? Now it's an interesting question. It depends on what do you think that file is made of. If the file was supposed to have been made of, if the file was supposed to be text file with tags, changing the order makes it gobbledygook. Right? You can't put like subsection 4.7.1 in the beginning of the paper and assume the paper doesn't change. So order actually matters. Okay? And in fact, the order matters. So for example, I can ask, what is the first time something appeared in a paper? Is it in section 1 or section 2 or a section 3? Okay? If you are coming to XML from databases, order shouldn't matter to you. Because if I have a table with a bunch of tuples, if you change the order of the tuples, it's still the same table. Okay? There are no ways of actually asking in the standard relational algebra, you don't ask for what is the, you know, you don't ask for, there is no ID for the rows in the table. Okay, there is no ID for the rows in the table. There is no identity for rows. Okay, so if I ask a query, I'll give you all the rows which satisfy, let's say if it's a selection query, I'll give you all the rows which satisfy that selection predicate. And any which order I give you, it's considered to be identical because it's a set semantics. Okay, but it would change if you are thinking of it as a text file. Okay, so what this essentially is a conflict now between, so the question here is, should XML care about order or not? What should be the default? Now, as you can imagine, depending on who you ask, if you ask database people, they say it shouldn't care about order. Okay, if you ask IR people, they say it should care about order. And since XML is supposed to be one standard, and further, more important than that, in fact, whether or not order matters on XML, how do you actually figure out whether order matters or not? You make a statement about whether or not order matters in terms of the answer for various queries. Okay? If the answer for a query does not depend upon the order in which the records are put in the table, then order doesn't matter. If it does, then it does matter. Okay? So in some sense, the question of order really is deeply connected to the question of doing query processing on XML files, which in some sense we are thinking we will do, because, you know, why would you have files unless you want to do some sort of queries on them? Okay? But the problem is text people have their own way of query processing. They were left to themselves, they would be doing, you know, vector similarity style query processing. That's their query processing. And then they can take structure into account. Database guys have their own way of query processing. And left to themselves, they would like to try and extend SQL to a query for XML. And left to these guys, they will try and extend whatever is query languages for text. In fact, keywords is the only thing we looked at, but there are other kinds of languages for IR. For example, I can say, give me all the files where word 1 appears 15 characters away from word 2, 15 words away from word 2. This is a classic IR query. It's reasonable to ask. Okay? But their languages are different. They tend to think in terms of words and their positions in the text, in the file, and so on. Okay, so they would like to extend their languages to support XQuery, support querying on XML. And so when we get to the point where we'll start talking about querying XML, we will see that there are general religious fights between IR style query languages for XML and database style query languages for XML. And in fact, in the beginning, they used to be, if you look at a query language for XML, for example, you know, style sheets, XSL can actually be seen, we'll see in a minute, as a query language. And IR people are happy with that sort of a query language. Whereas database people are much happier with a more declarative query language because that's what they are used to, which is SQL. And so there is a sort of a uneasy marriage of all of these into something called XQuery standard, which we'll look at, which currently is still sort of evolving, but it's reasonably stable. And it's supposed to make everybody happy. And you know how those things go. You know, any query language that tries to make everybody happy makes everybody moderately unhappy to some extent or other. But currently, database guys seem to sit on the standards committee for making XQuery in many more numbers than the IR guys, and so they are controlling. When you look at XQuery, it looks much more like SQL than like any other, you know, IR style query language. Okay, so it's interesting. I mean, the reason I brought this up here itself is upfront, you should not be surprised given this dichotomy at which, you know, there are two different reasons for coming to XML. Then you look at the same thing and look for different ways of using it. Okay. Now, are there any questions on whatever I just talked about till now? Yes. Yeah.
So are there efforts to measure like how structured a certain XML document is? Like, you know, if it has a lot of natural language in it, maybe it's less structured.
So in fact, that's a very interesting point. We'll talk about several questions that come up in your question. One of which is, if I give you an XML file, can you think of the grammar for it? Can you think of the schema for it? Okay? So if I give you a bunch of tuples in a database, can you guess what must have been the schema for that database? Okay, now that's not hard for relational databases because all tuples have exactly the same structure. So if I assume that if I tell you column name, value, column name, value, column name, value for each of the rows, and I give you like one row, you already know what the schema is. Because if I give you one row from a table, you know all the row, all the structure of all the rows in the table. But in case of XML, since if I show you like one tuple with just one author in the book, another tuple with three authors in the book, what's the generalization? And what is the gram? What must be the schema? If I told you the schema, then, you know, and I say that the schema said there can be up to five authors per book, then you can validate the XML file with respect to the schema. But if I didn't tell you the schema, then it's a question of finding like the tightest encircling grammar for this language fragment. It's a learning problem, which is a funny kind of learning problem where you learn only with positive examples. Right? I mean, nobody writes stuff that's not in the database or not in the file. And there's no such thing as this is not in the file and you write a line in the file. Okay, so everything in the file is a positive example, and you're starting from positive examples to try and learn the schema. That's, you know, one point. So something else that came to my mind when you asked this question. What was your question again? Yeah, so how structured something. If you know the schema, you can validate the file with respect to the schema, and that's one way you can measure it. If you don't know the schema, then you can learn a schema. And then say from now onwards, I assume that other data will be, so I'll see the first 15 tuples, then I assume what the, I'll decide what the schema is, then I'll start yelling at everybody else if they don't follow that schema. Okay, so that's one answer. Okay, and then of course this also means that there should be a way of specifying XML schema. And so there are standards for specifying XML schema. If you do want to specify XML schema, there is a standard for doing it. In fact, the old standard was something called DTD. We'll look at it. And the newer standard is something called XML schema. We'll look at it. And one of the nice things about all XML standards is they all look like XML. Syntactically, they all look like XML. Okay, which isn't particularly surprising. I mean, you should not put too much weight to that statement I said, which is all XML standards look, all XML standards are in XML. Okay? Lisp. Everything Lispy is in Lisp. Lisp data is in Lisp. Lisp programs are in Lisp. Okay? All of them are Lisp. One of the beautiful things about Lisp programs is they can start eating the bottom of the program and start processing it. So they can take programs as data and bring out new programs, which will then get evaluated. There is certain beauty, certain advantages to that sort of self-describing standard. Okay, XML is like Lisp. You know, it decided on a self-describing standard, and then XML schema will also have its own tags. All that will be changing is the specific tags that you would use, that you are constrained to use, would change. And those tags would have some meaning. Okay? And we'll look at this again when we get to the schema, XML schemas. But that's one way you'll talk about writing schemas for XML. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So here is another example of XML document, and there are some, you know, I hate teaching syntax, but I'll show a little of this, but you are supposed to go read the syntax up yourself. You know, I mean, there's not that much I can do. So there are some obvious things. This is a tag. These are all tags. Review, begin, review, end is a tag. There is no restriction at all on what can be a tag. Anything can be a tag. Once you start a tag, you end that tag at some point of time. If you don't end it, then it's an ill-formed, it's an ill-formed XML file. That's all. Okay, just as there's no restriction on how many parentheses you can have in list. Once you start a parenthesis, you end it. That's all you care. Okay? So think of them as a different colored parentheses. Review, begin, review, end, and so on. Now the other interesting thing you see is the records can have hierarchical structure. So review here. So this is, by the way, one interesting thing here is this fragment corresponds to a review. It's a movie review. Okay? So from IMDb. And it's saying the year is 1993. It's a record for a particular TV show which was made in the year 1993. Its title is The Fugitive. And here is one review of it from Sun Times, where the reviewer was Roger Ebert. And he gives rating 2 thumbs up. And then continues saying, a fun action movie, Harrison Ford at his best. Now, there's a lot of interesting things that's going on here. This is not databases anymore, right? So for example, yeah, I understand, title begin, fugitive the, title end. So the fugitive is the value of the tag title. Okay? And this is review begin, review end. So this whole stuff is the value of review. Now within that, sometimes begin, sometimes end, this whole stuff is the value of sometimes. This Roger Ebert is the value of this reviewer. What is this gives? What is it a value of? Nothing. Because XML, so from a date, if you are a database guy and you want to write database tuples, in relational data tuples into XML, there will never be this kind of free-floating text. Because everything would be between the column begin, column end of some column. Okay, but XML can also be there because you are an IR guy who has a bunch of text and you just happen to want to give some structure for some parts of it. So if I don't say anything, it's just normal text. If I say something, then that piece has that tag, and you know that piece is the value of a specific tag. Okay, so in this case, actually I'm using essentially, I'm completely allowed to use mixing of free text and tag value system, which is very nice, because then one of the advantages is, in fact, one of the most important advantages of XML is anything which eats HTML files can potentially be made to eat XML files. Okay, things that eat HTML files are browsers, and they eat them and they'll show you something. Okay, the standards, all you need to do to make something eat XML file and show it to you is to provide a rendering standard for the XML. Okay? Saying anytime you see the word show, show, then put the next, the year number in big letters, for example. And whenever you see title, convert title to slash I begin, slash I end. I mean, so tag I begin, tag I end. Okay? This is essentially converting. What I need to do is I take this and I need to give you a little algorithm which says convert all reviews to italics, all sun times to the following kind of HTML structure. Okay. Once I do that, then it becomes HTML and it will just get rendered. If I don't give you anything at all, then it can just write down the whole thing in the order in which it appears in some reasonable indentation. That's the default. But if I give you specific ways of rendering XML, and that's called the style sheets. Okay? A style sheet essentially is converting, is supposed to tell you how to convert an XML fragment into an HTML fragment. But in so doing, it has the ability to convert an XML fragment into a different XML fragment, because HTML is nothing but another XML fragment. Okay, so because of this, we'll see later that in fact style sheets can also be thought of as a query processing program, because when you convert the structure of XML file, then in essence you are changing the way, you know, for example, I could say I could read this and my conversion grammar says only pick the year and put the title of the show and ignore everything else and only show that. That would be like picking the year and the title name, selecting the year and the title name from a record. So that's like query processing. Okay? In using our Lisp standard, Lisp terminology, for those of you who remember, in fact, style sheets can be thought of as print functions for structure or print functions for objects. And it's just that you are representing these print functions using a grammar transformation. You know, here is one XML fragment. Here is how you transfer into a different XML fragment. And if that new fragment is HTML, that just is rendering. If it also happens to be XML, that, think of it as query processing. Okay? Every tag ends, and there is mixed content. You know, the whole tag and its value is called an element. Elements can be hierarchically structured. One other cute thing, which is kind of annoying, is that apart from elements, you also have attributes. Okay, so you have show year equal to 1994. Now, the problem is you could actually have written this as show begin, year begin, 1994 year end. That is a syntactically equivalent way. I'm sorry, that's another way of representing this data. Okay, but it's just they provide you both the attribute representation as well as the element-based representation. Okay, that's part of the syntax of XML. What else do we have? So these are all the names. You have tags. In the previous case, book. I mean, so not in the previous case. Things like book, title, author, anything you make up would be a type tag name. You can start the tag and the tag. Okay, start tag and end tag. You know, the inside, the entire tag and its internals and the end of the tag. That's an element. Elements can be nested. You can have empty elements, and in fact empty elements is a way of just saying something is red. You want to just say something is red, I can say red begin, red end. Okay, and they also have some syntactic shortcuts. If you ever want to say red begin, red end, you can just say red backslash, I mean forward slash instead of so red and slash at the end. So that would be like equivalent to those two. Okay. So an XML document has a single root element from which all these element structures are coming. So it's easy to think of it as a nice tree. Okay. And it's an XML document is well formed if it has matching tags. And it's valid if it follows the grammar that it's supposed to follow. If I don't tell you what grammar it's supposed to follow, then it's valid, because I didn't tell you what it's supposed to follow. If I did tell you what grammar it's supposed to follow, then you can check whether it is valid or not. Okay, grammar essentially is what is the schema that that XML is supposed to have, and there is a way of describing that. We'll look at it in a minute. We talked about XML and order already. The other thing is, okay, so this is just XML and attributes. This is interesting. XML can actually have, one of the reasons to actually have the attributes is you can use the attributes as IDs and refer back to the IDs. Okay, the moment you do that, from a database point of view, you went out of relational databases. In a relational database, you can't say, give me the fourth row. There's no way. You can only say, give me the row. If you ever need to say, give me the fourth row, then you need to make an extra column for each row, calling the ID of that row and put a number there, and then you do a selection on that number. There is no fourth row, there is no fifth row in table. What is the kind of databases are there where you can refer to things by their name? So in databases, you can't refer to things by their name. You can only refer to things by selecting over their values. You say, give me all the rows which have this column equal to this, or give me all the rows which have this column less than this column, assuming both of them are numbers. That's all I can do. I can't say, give me all the rows whose name happens to be the following thing. In object-oriented databases, you can refer to individual objects. By throwing this stuff into XML, where you have IDs and you can refer to IDs back, you are allowing XML to also be a syntactic standard for object-oriented databases. Okay, it's a big deal from the point of view of what you can represent using the syntactic structure. Okay, so in this particular case, person whose ID is 0555, whose name happens to be Jane, and the person ends, and now person 0456, whose name is Mary, whose children has ID ref, which are 0123 and 0555. 0555 is this. So it's like a reference back to an already defined entity. So you're calling by name, and that's object oriented. Okay. We already talked about HTML versus XML. Are there any questions on that? I mean, it's just HTML is XML. It's just that its tags mean something to somebody. XML is HTML whose tags do not have to mean anything to anybody. I mean, so I'm actually taking an extreme stance so that you will never think XML has meaning. Okay, the first normal mistake people do is to assume we need semantics for the data, so we'll put it in XML. Okay, that's gobbledygook. All you are showing is sectional structure. The names that you are putting in the tags don't mean anything to anybody. They are not guaranteed to mean anything to anybody unless we all agree to use the same tag names. We standardize the tag names. The word standards and the word web, they kind of clash. Okay, nobody follows standards. The fewer the standards, the better. Okay, especially meaning-related standards, nobody is going to follow. Right? So, in fact, it turns out that there are standardizations for XML tags. They would, however, be restricted to very specific pieces. For example, if you want to define the schema of an XML file, you would use XML schema. And normally, what you do is you define a new namespace for XML schema. In that namespace, there are only certain tags you are allowed to use, and they all have agreed upon meanings. And what that means is, meaning essentially, what I mean by meaning is that tag will get interpreted by the validator in a certain way. Whereas any normal XML tag, a validator doesn't know what to do with it. Okay? So why are database people so excited about XML? I don't know. There are no database people here. There are some. One, as I said, XML, they're interested in it because it does provide syntax for self-describing data. And that's exciting because there's no standard syntax for relational data. And so with XML, we can translate any data into XML format. Then databases can essentially exchange data in the self-describing format. So at least they don't have to do the unwrapping part. That looks like an advantage, but it's not a huge advantage. At least you can avoid wrapper generation. But then you get stuck after that because you have the column name, you have the value, you don't know what this column name means. Okay? But it's better than nothing. So you can exchange data in XML format, ship over the web, input to any application. So anything which can accept XML format, so everybody is now supposed to accept XML syntaxic format. It's like every list, everything should accept lists. You know, that's, you know, saying everything should accept XML is as much of a restriction as saying everything must accept lists. That's it. No more, no less. Okay, a list can be of anything. And I'm not saying what type of list. I'm not saying how many nesting should be allowed in the list. I'm just saying you should allow lists. And similarly, I'm saying, you know, when I say support XML, I should allow tagged data. That's all. Now, this is, you know, continuing my interest in pushing this point that XML is not meaning. Okay. If you ever forget this, look at these slides. Unfortunately, for those of you who can start reading this, I apologize because the whole point is lost. It's Chinese, and you're not supposed to know Chinese. I mean, but we have lots of Chinese here. So they know exactly what is there. But for those of you who don't know Chinese, and this stuff may not mean much to you. And in fact, I think it is Chinese, right? It's not Japanese or Korean or anything. Somebody speak up. Can people start reading? Okay. So there is stuff here, and some people here know it. The rest of you have no clue what it is, right? I have no clue. And this is how a web page looks like to something that is processing this web page from the point of view of query retrieval. If I convert this page into XML, I can say this is name, name begin, name end, education begin, this whole thing is education, so now this whole thing is CV, CV begin, CV end, this part is education, education begin, education end, this part is work, work begin, work end, this part is private, private begin, private end. All of a sudden, I mean, imagine these people only knew Chinese, and who is the only person, the rest of America only knows English. I mean, actually, you know this story, which no longer is unfortunately true. There is this, when I first came not too long ago, I heard this story that there are bilinguals, there are polyglots, and there are Americans, right? So the idea is Americans only know one language, which is no longer true. They don't also know one language. That's a different story. but the idea is, if in fact some people only know the inside part and the rest of you only know the English part, you suddenly start thinking, yeah, now I understand. Yeah, this must be education, some sort of Chinese education. This must be some sort of Chinese word. This must be some sort of Chinese name. This must be some sort of Chinese private stuff. Okay, you feel extremely good now. Unfortunately, that's just you, because you know English. Okay, and there are a bunch of Telugu people here, the thing that I speak, yeah. And if they forget the English, to them it looks like this, right? All they know is this stuff is some gobbledygook begin, gobbledygook end. This stuff is another gobbledygook begin, gobbledygook end. This whole stuff is a big gobbledygook in which there is a small, three small gobbledygooks of different kinds. That's all you know. Unfortunately, because you happen to know the meanings for this, you start imposing, overloading what this means. Okay? But your program doesn't know English. Okay, so they actually think of this as another string, that's all. Really, all the program knows is there is a structure to this file such that this piece corresponds to the column name this, this piece, whole thing corresponds to this column name, this piece corresponds to this column name, and so on. Okay, so XML tags do not tell meaning unless we have agreed upon meanings for tags. The reason we all agree, we all seem to think we know it, is because we've been forced to learn a language. Learning a language means agreeing upon certain standard meanings for words. Okay? Now, so your machine thinks these are different things. Now, now of course, you can start trying to provide meanings to these tags, for example, except what might happen is, you know, if you have two different XML files with for two different tags, you might start saying, well, the tag here corresponds to the tag here. The tag here is the, you know, is the combination of this tag and this tag. Okay, that's essentially the idea of schema mapping from the database point of view. So the column names, I am giving you two tables, they have the same width. The column names are different strings. Okay, so for example, one table says person, one table says human. And maybe the meaning of the data is such that person and human are the same. In which case, somebody has to tell the guy who is reading both these databases that these two columns are the same. Okay, so you need to provide this sort of a, you know, at least if everybody is using the same tags, even if you don't know what they mean, you can at least say the following thing. Even if I have no clue what's inside, what's outside, if I get a whole bunch of XML records of this type, then I can say the union of all the gobbledygook ones is this plus all those things. And the union of all the gobbledygook twos is this plus this and so on. But then somebody else will start writing the same thing with a different tag set. All I know is that they're just different strings. They could actually mean different things for the guy who wrote it, or they could mean the same thing. I have no clue. Okay? And so, what do I need to do? I need to now start providing mapping between this thing here and this thing here. Okay? When was the last time we had this kind of a problem? We pretty much had this problem, I guess, since the Tower of Babel happened, right? If you are into that story. But the way, so for example, if I have P of X implies Q of X, okay, and if somebody else says the two logical sentences from first order logic. Okay, now how do I make sense of, how do I relate this guy to this guy? If I want to relate them, I write an extra logical sentence that combines both of them. Okay, the point that you're supposed to remember from, you know, if you ever took logic or if you took knowledge representation in 471, meaning comes from interrelation. Okay, and we know this from like the day one. You know, you can play with kids saying, here is a rose, but let's call it bread. And they will play along with you. They'll say, yeah, the bread smells good. The bread is a beautiful flower. You know, they know that the word that you use to refer to something does not have meaning inside of itself. What the meaning comes from how the word is related to other words. If I said rose equal to bread, then everything that rose, every relation that rose had with other things, now bread has with other things. And so that's how I actually establish meaning. Okay, and so in case of XML2, these tags look like somebody is sort of standardizing the world, and you know, you'll no longer have the Tower of Babel and things will be good. But unfortunately, that's not the case, because unless you stick to the same set of tags and everybody agrees what those tags mean, and the agreement is then codified in terms of programs that do certain things to those tags, the tags don't mean anything. Okay? So there are several ways of dealing with this. This is seen in many different formats. It's called schema mapping from the database literature. It's called ontology mapping from the semantic web literature that we will talk about a little bit later. And in general, it is, you know, providing meanings to words by relating them. Okay? There are the way you can handle this problem. First, I have to, you know, the main point I want you to remember by the end of this class is XML does not have any meaning. XML is like Lisp, in the sense Lisp is made up of lists, that's all. Okay? That's the only thing that you know. But when you start talking about specific kinds of words in Lisp have special semantics. Defun is a definition of a function. Cond is the beginning of an if statement. Why do we know this? We all agree on those meanings for that by reading up the Lisp reference manual, and we better use it in that meaning, because there is a Lisp interpreter and compiler which uses, which does things to the Lisp program that you wrote, or Lisp data you wrote, in terms of what this particular meaning. But for the rest of the things in the Lisp, it doesn't do anything to them. There is no meaning to them. That rest of that meaning has to come through the interrelations between the pieces of the program that you write. Okay, so in general, now that XML doesn't deal with the semantic heterogeneity problem, that's the other beautiful word you will keep hearing in it, semantic heterogeneity. The rest of the semester is going to be a chock full of jargon. Part of it is to remember, you know, which equivalence class of jargon really corresponds to one specific concept. There are not that many concepts, but there are multiple ways of referring to it. Okay, schema mapping, semantic heterogeneity, they all are talking about this issue. Okay, there are solutions to this that you can institutionalize. For example, you can decide on a standard up front and then use those tags. HTML decided on standard. It said, if you write tag begin B, tag end, I will do certain things to you. You may like it, you may not like it. If you write it, I'll show it in, you know, bold. And I forget, what's the tag for blinking? I mean, that's a really evil thing. If there is a tag for blinking, and if you put it, it will start blinking that stuff at you.
Blink.
What? Blink.
And it puts up
my own. I know, it's very sad. I mean, so, but the point is that you institutionalize the meaning of those tags in HTML. But that's not the only place they got institutionalized. Much before XML became like a big thing because of the open standards of the web, there were specific sub-communities such as electronics vendors, electronics parts vendors, who have defined an elaborate tag system. So if you have a little thingamajiggy resistor which has, you know, a certain type of properties, there is a specific set of tags that you use to describe that resistor. And nobody other than an electronic vendor would know it. But if all electronics vendors agree on that, they can then freely exchange the data. And this is done already. You know, different small communities can decide, agree on standards and exchange data with respect to those standards. But doing it at a web level is hard, because, you know, electronics community people agreed because there is some sort of an economic motive. If everybody agrees and one guy doesn't agree, then that guy, whatever he's trying to sell, nobody is going to be able to make sense of them, and so they would lose money. So there is an economic motivation. Who stops me from setting up any random web page? Who stops me from putting any random tags on it? Nobody. So you could either standardize for sub communities, or you can, and then one other interesting thing you can do is, if this whole community is standardized, then you can provide a mapping between their tags and these guys' tags. Instead of, so if there are N people in this community, M people in this community, and each of them can make any random tags, then you need N times M mappings. If you say this, it means this to this guy. If you say this, it means this to this guy. And if there are, these N of them use one standard, these M of them use another standard, you can just do it with one mapping between these two standards. But this is sort of stabilizing the environment by, you know, making different subsets of people speak the same language. It does not, you know, magically remove the problem. It's just you are institutional, you're kind of enforcing some standards that will, you know, have a, make it easier to deal with it. The other issues is you can learn what these tags mean over a period of time. So if they are not agreeing, if there is no mapping that's being given humanly, then you can say, okay, this tuple here seems to mean this tuple here. This tuple here seems to mean this tuple here. I'll give you 15 examples. From that, you can try to learn what must be the same as, what here must be the same as what here. And that is schema mapping through learning techniques. Okay? We will get to this in good time. The one thing that I want you to look at next time is play with this URL there, which allows you to play with XQuery, which looks like, so you know, it allows you to specify a query and run it on XML fragments and give you results back. Much of what we will do next class is to talk about XML schema standard and XQuery standard, and then go from there to other standards, which called semantic web standards, which try to essentially do these mappings between different XML pieces. Okay? Stop here.